flying saucers are real.
They've seen the aliens buzzing our missile silos.
The UFO phenomenon, either we like it or not, is already very much part of our reality.
That caused a compass needle to spin and spin.
And that's where the whole seed for the idea of underground bases at Dulce was planted.
They had very large eyes, and you know, I found their stare extremely difficult to bear.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis. Welcome to Podcast UFO for episode number 40 with Ryan Sprague. He's a great young guest, and he'll be coming up after the news. The show is growing all the time. We're listened to in about 131 countries. I get a lot of email, and I do apologize if you're listening right now and you've been sending me email and I can't answer it. I answer as many emails as I can. My email address is martin@podcastufo.com. Some people choose to use the contact form when they're emailing me, and I want to read this this message that came in. It says, podcast person, that's who I am, I guess, your shows were better off without news. You have a pathetic sense of humor. So, Michael, you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. So I wrote this guy back. I sent him an email that came through in the contact form, and I said, hey, thank you for your opinion. Please join our forum. And his email bounced back. So he gave a fake email address. And, you know, I don't mind if someone sends me hate mail. I kind of enjoy hate mail sometimes, but, you know, don't take that as a hint that you have to send it. But I learn something from it sometimes. Please do, if you're listening again, please do join the forum. And you know what? If you want me to stop with my sense of humor, how corny or whatever it is, just donate some money. We have a donate button right on the side of our website. So I will listen to you more if you donate money. How's that, Michael?
I think that's a sound policy.
Okay, great. So what's up for news this week?
All right, we'll start this week with the FBI statement on the Guy Hodel memo, which, if anybody read our recent blog post on the Aztec UFO incident, it is the FBI memo that was mentioned in that article. And on March 25th, the Guy Hodel memo, an FBI document from 1950 mentioning reports of three crashed saucers recovered in New Mexico, was the subject of a feature piece on the FBI's website. It points out that the memo is merely relaying an informant's report and does not actually prove the existence of UFOs. But it also states that the memo is the most popular file available through the FBI's vault, which is a page of declassified documents. You can read that article through the link in our show notes.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that they've had over a million views of this document.
Yeah, it's like they say point blank, it is the most popular of all the things they've declassified. And there's actually a lot of interesting declassified stuff in the FBI vault.
I read that memo before in the past, and I know that it actually talks about the saucers. I think they say they're 50 feet or so wide, and there's beings in them with metallic clothing or something like that. You know, it's the best part is that they were shot down through using their high-power radar, which you've talked about in the past.
Right.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. And it's that just the fact that it's on the FBI site is actually kind of exciting in a way.
Yeah, and they actually, in the article, they go into a little bit about the FBI's involvement in UFOs and some other declassified pages there. So it's definitely an article worth checking out through the link on our show notes.
Yeah.
All right, and the Houston fireball mystery has been solved. A wave of Houston UFO sightings this past weekend appears to have merely been a group of those infamous Chinese lanterns launched at a wedding. You can watch a local report on the UFO sightings and the wedding party lanterns through the link in our show notes. And really, this is almost non-news, but it was a huge kind of a tempest there Monday morning. And if you watch the report that we've linked to and see these Chinese lanterns, I think you'll see that, yes, these probably were Chinese lanterns, but it gives you a really good view of what they look like, because they don't look like a whole lot of sightings that are chalked up to be Chinese lanterns.
I watched a video on YouTube where it was clearly Chinese lanterns, and the people recording it were like screaming about, you know, seeing this UFO and all that, and it's just another thing to muddy the water. I'm not really a fan of the Chinese lanterns for that fact.
I don't like the idea that people just kind of launch these flaming mm-hmm. tissue paper balloons randomly. I was very surprised at how many cities just allow that.
It almost seems like a fire hazard. You know, I mean, I know they do catch on fire sometimes.
You know, when I was probably fourth or fifth grade, we built paper hot air balloons with Sterno, basically Chinese lanterns. And I remember, I mean, the school, we had the fire department there and all that good stuff. And one of them did crash and set the football field on fire. So, it you know, so what are you people thinking who are setting these off?
Yeah, no kidding.
U.S. UFO reports are down so far in 2013. Roger Marsh maintains in a recent Examiner.com article that reported UFO sightings in the United States have dropped this year compared to the first quarter of last year. Drawing on data from a couple of reporting agencies, he has concluded that sightings are down approximately one-third so far this year. You can read his report through the link in our show notes.
I personally think that's a government cover-up. No, I'm kidding. I'm wondering why that is. It just seems like there's more going on, but, you know, maybe that's right. And, you know, this is all statistics, I'm sure. I know this sounds really corny, but it's been kind of a harsh winter. I wonder if maybe they're kind of staying away.
Well, I mean, whether they're staying away or just people are staying inside.
There you go. That's a good point.
And speaking of the harsh winter, are pond circles the new crop circles? A series of odd melted circles in a frozen pond have baffled an upstate New York woman. So she posted them on a local news broadcaster's Facebook page. Now the mysterious circles are being likened to crop circles and have attracted attention from all over the globe. Even though Peggy Gervais reports the circles appeared without her seeing or hearing anything strange, they are being attributed to everything from UFOs to methane gas. And you can see that original report by the local station WGRZ through the link in our show notes. Did you get a chance to see those pond circles?
Yes, I did. And, you know, this is the first time that I'm going to be serious when I say these two words, swamp gas. You know, it's probably most likely gas. I mean, it's really, you know, it's almost like maybe if Russell Crowe could take this and go with it, he could go somewhere. But, you know, it's really, it just looks like a natural anomaly. It doesn't look anything, you know.
It's odd, but I mean, to me, I didn't see a pattern in it. So I didn't see where it was like crop circles.
Yeah. It's really too bad this is getting a lot of publicity. You know?
And it is getting a lot of publicity. I first actually ran across it in a news story from England. Now something a little more down to earth, and that would be SpaceX's second cargo mission has landed successfully on our planet. The SpaceX Dragon capsule's return to Earth, completing its second successful cargo mission to the International Space Station. It brought back over 2,600 pounds of equipment and material, including a Lego set that has been on the space station for the past 2 years. We have a link to the space.com coverage in our show notes. And, you know, I'm very excited about the privatization of space. I don't know. How do you feel about it, Martin?
Oh, I think it's great. And, you know, I think it just opens up a lot of doors. And, you know, the people that are getting involved in this are showing ways to save money that NASA really didn't care all that much about. And I'm sure it's really causing a little bit of a stir as far as NASA goes. Speaking of NASA, I know this isn't in our news, but did you happen to read the head of NASA says that if a large asteroid is headed to New York City, we better pray?
Yes, which is why I do not live in New York. And finally, this podcast is scheduled to be released on Friday, March 29th. I'd like to take a moment to tell listeners that Podcast UFO will have a very important announcement from a major researcher on our website, podcastufo.com, this Monday. Martin, I realize you are under an obligation to keep this secret prior to Monday's announcement, but can you give the listeners some kind of clue of what's going on?
Well, I can only say this, that if you happen to listen to this podcast after Monday, this is you know, the 29th, if you happen to listen to it after Monday, that it's going to be too late. And I'm sorry about that, but it's real important for you to stop by our website on Monday. Please spread the word, too, to everyone out there. This Monday, I think it's the first day of next month. I need everybody to visit podcastufo.com, if you would, please. There is one thing I can announce, though. Our first forum guest star will be on our forum from Saturday, March 30th through Wednesday, April 3rd. And that's Peter Robbins, author and lecturer. He's a co-author of Left at Eastgate. And Michael, can you explain basically what the guest star on the forum is going to be about?
Sure. What we're going to do is open up a special topic area on the forums just for Peter Robbins, and we're going to let all of our forum members start discussions, ask him questions. I believe he has said that he doesn't plan on starting any threads. He just wants to answer all of the questions. But it'll be a chance to kind of have a Q&A session with Peter Robbins for all the times that you might have tried to call in a radio show and not been able to get through. This is a way better shot because you have a few days at it. And when are you going to be opening up the forum for questions?
Actually, I think I'll open it by the time this podcast gets released. I think I'll open it. So you can check it out if you happen to listen to us right away on Friday. I'll have that forum open and you can start posing questions. He will start answering on the 30th. He will be back every day, once a day, to answer all the questions. So anyway, I think this is a little bit of an experiment. It was actually your idea, Michael. Thank you for that.
Just trying to pitch in.
That's it for the news, right?
That is it for the news this week. Since, unless you want to tell us what's going on Monday.
I can't, but please do stop by our website. Thanks a lot, Michael, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, have a good show.
Thank you. Okay, I'm with Ryan Sprague. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great, Martin.
Thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show. I want to start right away by saying you're one of the possibly the youngest guests that I've had on the show so far.
Well, I feel very honored.
Yeah, and we're going to touch on a whole bunch of things. You came back from a conference recently. We can talk about that. First of all, I want to ask, what started you on the path of interest of ufology?
I probably got interested, Martin, when I was about, I'd say 12 or 13 years old. I never had that quintessential sighting that a lot of these researchers have had, but I did trip into the library one day. I was a big bookworm, and I found a book by Stanton Friedman, one of your previous guests, about the Roswell crash, and it completely just astounded me. As young as I was, it sort of blew my mind. It wasn't anything I'd ever read about in textbooks or seen anywhere on the news, and sort of scared me. I took it out that day from the library, and to be completely honest, I've yet to return it. It sort of made its way into my library here at home, and the library police never came for it. So that's where I got started, Martin. I sort of researched the topic on my own, didn't really tell many of my friends, you know, the ridicule factor that goes with all of that. Yeah. I was interested in girls and sports, and this was just sort of something I did for myself, and it sort of evolved from there.
Before we get into your play, which I think is fascinating, and I wanted to ask you how you pulled that off, is I want to talk about the conference you just attended. Let's talk about that.
Sure. That was the 2013 International UFO Congress, Martin. I was hired by Open Minds Productions, who are the authors of the Open Minds magazine. I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with that. They took over hosting this event about 3 years ago, where it used to be in Laughlin. It's now in the Arizona area. And it's the biggest UFO conference in the country. It lasts for 7 days, endless amounts of speakers and vendors, and all the top people were there. You had Stanton Friedman, Richard Doland, Micah Hanks, James Fox, just anyone you could think of in the field was there. Even if they weren't speaking, you know, they attended, and very, very big array of people. And it was very exciting, you know, seeing these people up close and having conversations with them and seeing families attending these things. You know, it's no longer the days of these white-haired men in their tweed suits, all these sort of presumptions we make in the UFO field. It's it's tapping into a younger generation, and I couldn't be more happy to be involved with it.
Wow, that's great. We talked a little bit before the recording here, and you said a lot of people were pretty approachable.
Very much so. You know, we sort of have these assumptions that these people are celebrities. You know, we see them on these TV shows or we hear them in interviews, and we don't really know what to make of it. But I'm telling you, once you're there and you even introduce yourself, they will talk to you for as long as you want. I asked Richard Dolan for a 5-minute interview with him, and it lasted over an hour and a half. and those are just the sort of things you can't make up. Very informative, very exciting. And what I like to always tell people is we are the people that they are ultimately making their careers out of. We're the ones having these sightings, and mm-hmm. we're the ones going out into the field, as it were, and making these things happen. So, like I said, very exciting and a good little break from my life here in New York City, for sure.
Right, right. And let's talk about your play that you're working on. And you've had our past guest, Peter Robbins, help you with that.
That's correct. Peter is a hero of mine, for sure, Martin. He is one of the nicest guys in the world, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. Very knowledgeable, not just in the UFO field, but in many different fields as well.
Right.
He himself is an artist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He worked in the world of theater for a very long time. And when I approached him about this idea of writing a play about a very familiar case to him, he was very excited. We'd spoken a few times before. I wrote an article about the 1980 Rendlesham UFO incident for Open Minds magazine, where I interviewed Peter and also Larry Warren, one of the key witnesses to mm-hmm. the case. And it wasn't until about a couple months ago when I was part of a playwriting competition here in New York, and I wrote a short play, about 10 minutes long, about the Rendlesham UFO incident. And it went over amazingly with people. They had no idea it was based on an actual event, but they were extremely intrigued by it. And I had a gentleman come up to me after with a British accent, and I immediately knew he knew that this was something real. And he grew up right near Rendlesham Forest and was very happy I decided to write something about this, and flat out told me this story needs to be told. And that's sort of where the idea for the full-length play came from, Martin. And that is when I approached Peter. I read his book, Left at East Gate, about 3 times, and it just had a perfect story arc in it, and I knew it had to be a movie, or it had to be a play, something. And that's when I made the phone call that ultimately started the project.
And where does it sit right now?
I'm about, I would say, 85% done with the first draft of the play, Martin. It is still in the development process. The research that goes into these things is astounding. You know, it took Peter and Larry Warren 10 years to write that book, Left at East Gate. But this is a true account. You know, I will take liberties with the play, obviously. You need to fill a good mm-hmm. 2 hours with content. But there will be dialogue that's verbatim from the incident. Peter Robbins has given me access to cassette tapes that were from Larry Warren, one of the key witnesses, regression tapes from what he remembers of the incident, conversations with Colonel Charles Halt, who was the base commander during the Rendlesham incident. And it's amazing what Peter has given me access to. And I'm trying to do justice to this case, Martin, make it as true as I can, and open it up to an audience that rarely ever thinks about the UFO topic, and that's the world of theater.
I think Halt really gives a lot of integrity to that case, you know, specifically because, you know, he set out to debunk it that night when he first went out and grabbed his tape recorder. And that every time I hear that tape recording of when the object was overhead and shot down that beam, it's like chilling.
It is. It's startling. I've listened to that tape so many times, Martin, but it gives me goosebumps every time. Just to hear the inflection in his voice and hear the other men in the background, you know, commenting on what they're seeing, you could tell that these men were scared out of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when your perception of reality changes in an instant and you're seeing things that you've never seen before, these men were trained to look for every type of aircraft you can possibly think of. You know, this was during the Cold War, so any sort of intrusion was going to be taken extremely seriously. And it's amazing. I love that audio tape. You know, Colonel Charles Halt wishes it had never been leaked to the public, but it did. And to hear him recently, within the past year or so, state that he believes that this was of extraterrestrial origin is amazing. And to admit that something affected the nuclear ordnance that was being held on the base is amazing. The developments in this case are happening every day, and I think that's why this story needs to be told. It's still a living story, unlike Roswell or some of these other famous cases. Not to say there's anything wrong with that. It's just all these people are still alive and willing to tell their stories, so so let's let them.
Now, that tape also, there's a longer version. I mean, in documentaries, you hear the short version, but there is a longer version available on YouTube. I've listened to it. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, now, it is, yeah.
Now, there has been quite a bit of controversy about one of the main characters in that. You probably know who I mean.
I'm sure I do, yes.
Yeah, there's a time travel thing that's supposed to come out. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard probably about the same as you, Martin, and some of the other listeners. The two men that were involved on the second night of events, this was a three-night event in Rendlesham Forest. On the second night, a structured craft was seen in the forest, and two of the men witnessed it, and one of them even touched the craft, went up to it, and it felt warm to the touch, and he saw strange symbols on it, recorded them in his notebook, and as soon as he touched one of these symbols, he states that a binary code of such was downloaded into his brain. He subsequently wrote this down in his notebook and had it deciphered, and the message was very compelling. It had a longitude and latitude of a location called High Brazil, which supposedly at one time had a very knowledgeable and advanced civilization living there. Civilization, I mean human. I do apologize. But just very advanced with their technology and the way that their society was advancing. It also had a message that, you know, obviously I can't quote it verbatim, but something to do with we are you and we are watching, and we want you to be careful. You know, that's a very condensed and way of looking at it, but very interesting. It's interesting that this has come forward, you know, 32 years after the fact, but interesting nonetheless. A lot of the witnesses to this case, wedges have been drawn between them all, and it's very unfortunate it has to be that way, but there seems to be another hand at work in all this, Martin. Perhaps disinformation, perhaps perhaps some sort of superiors making these things happen so that the true story never comes out. I'm interested to hear it. The two officers who have made these claims are writing a book about it with Nick Pope, and I'm very interested to see their proof for sure.
Yeah, and there was a lot of debunking, of course, and I recently heard one of the skeptics talk about the rabbit holes instead of the impressions. And, of course, we always hear about the lighthouse. Those are just so archaic to what really happened. You know,
they really are. That's a great point, Martin. It's almost insulting to these men to think that they couldn't tell the difference between a lighthouse constantly rotating and what they were seeing right over their heads. It's like I said, it's very insulting and very easy to disprove as well. You know, skeptics sort of, I have nothing against skeptics. I am a skeptical believer myself, but when you start
the debunking,
exactly, when you dumb it down to the levels that they have, it is very insulting, not only to those men, but to the UFO field in general, for sure. You know, we do take time to really look at these things and know the difference between a lighthouse and what over 30 and 40 enlisted members of the military saw. So,
getting back to your play, you know, I thought about this a little bit. It seems like it would be quite an undertaking to try to take on something like this with, for instance, how would someone create some type of effect of a craft? and also, you know, you have a lot of exterior type scenes I'm picturing. And it just seems like quite an undertaking to be able to figure out how to make this whole thing work. Have you thought all this out?
Right, right. That's a very good question, Martin. A lot of people have actually asked me, you know, how are you going to have these crafts flying in the forest? And what I'm trying to make clear to people is this is a very human story. And what I've decided to do is chronicle the 10 years it took Larry Warren and Peter Robbins to write their book about the incident. That is not to say that the event itself in Rendlesham Forest will not be alluded to, and it also doesn't take any of the excitement out of the play. Trust me, what happened after the incident is just as intriguing as what happened during it. So I will be chronicling Larry Warren's experiences afterwards. You know, he was debriefed after what he witnessed in the forest, and other officers have corroborated his story on what they were debriefed on. I'm more than happy to go into that if you wish.
Yes, I'd like to know a little bit about that because I've heard some varied stories on what happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I know the story broke loose, actually. Wasn't it Larry Warren himself who actually leaked the story eventually?
That's correct. I believe it was in 83, Martin, when Larry really came to the forefront and blew the whistle off the entire thing. You know, he told friends and family about what happened to him there, but it wasn't until then that he was sick of it. He was sick of being downplayed and threatened by the Air Force and the powers that be, and he wanted the story to be told. And that's where the HALT tape ultimately came from as well, and the HALT memo, if you will, the condensed version of the three nights that made it out to the public. I believe it was titled Unexplained Lights in the Forest. This was all done by Larry's hand, and that's why a lot of the other witnesses, and Colonel HALT included, they sort of have a, not a disdain, but they disagree with Larry on many things, mostly because Larry is one of the only ones that was involved on the third night of events. Others have come forward and cooperated his story, like I said earlier. But yes, Larry states he was brought into a room the following day, and there were 20 other officers there. And they were told that civilizations travel to this planet from time to time. They come and go as they please. And this is something that is in cooperation with the government. And it's a monitoring sort of project between us and them. Larry was told that if he ever spoke about the events, that bullets are cheap, and there have been other officers that have come forward and say they heard the same thing. But yes, obviously it's been over 30 years since the event. Stories become distorted, but this is the story that Larry sticks to till today, and that's the story I'm telling in the play.
Do other people corroborate exactly what the briefing was to them as well?
Yes, there are a couple other officers who have said that they were literally in that room with Larry and that they did hear the same thing. They state that some of the officers were completely in shock and couldn't handle it, ran out of the room. One of the officers committed suicide, Martin, a couple days later. He was a very religious guy, and he couldn't fathom the fact that there was life elsewhere out there and that his God would let this happen. Larry Warren was one of the officers who found him moments after the event happened. This is the effects that this event had on some of these people. A lot of them suffered from post-traumatic stress afterwards, Larry included, and a lot of them had health problems. There were high levels of radiation all three nights of the event, and the government refuses to help these men pay for their medical bills. So that alone tells you why Larry would come forward with this and why he put so much distrust in the government that he was working for.
The statement that you just said there, that supposedly the officers said during the debriefing that we are being visited from time to time, you know, I mean, if that could actually be proven that they actually said that, what an amazing event that would be.
Oh, yeah, it would change everything, Martin. I mean, obviously, we only have these men's word for it, but if that is true, that's the biggest thing that we could ultimately find out about all this.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Ryan, this is really interesting, some of these things that you're saying that I've never heard of, especially the debriefing there. Do you have any other little tidbits you can throw our way that's about that story that you're aware of?
About the debriefing in specific, Martin, or what happened?
Well, the debriefing, I think, is fascinating, mm-hmm. You know, some of the things you just said. Do you know anything more about that?
There have been some other sort of, I guess, developments, Martin. A lot of the officers state that there were video cameras recording all of this. If that's true, I want to see these tapes, you know. I want to see these recordings. Not just audio. We're talking about video here. And both Larry and I believe it was Sergeant Adrian Pastinza, who was also involved in, I believe it was two of the nights of events, states that they saw these video canisters at the time. I mean, you gotta think of the time period. They were using these big motion picture cameras at the time. The films were brought to the airfield and were brought onto a plane and shipped off to Germany, to Ramstein. And a few of the officers state that they heard that this is the location that these tapes were brought to. So it is possible that somewhere in Germany they hold a lot of the evidence in the Rendlesham case. Again, why they were brought there, we may never know, but very interesting.
It is. What about the British government? Did they have anything to say about all this? It's kind of sketchy.
It is a little sketchy, Martin, and I can sort of tell you why with that. Apparently, Britain wanted very little to do with any of this. I don't believe I mentioned it earlier, but the bases that all these men were on were U.S.-owned over in England. We were there to help NATO in protecting Britain against any sort of attacks. So therefore, the incident happened on basically quote-unquote American soil. Rendlesham Forest itself obviously is publicly owned, but the incidents were being reported by the U.S. Therefore, Britain wanted very little to do with this. They did not want to get their hands dirty, especially when it came down to the fact that this was a UFO case. So that's sort of how Britain handled it. You know, they sort of turned a blind eye and let the United States do what they pleased with the case. And that was obviously to put a lid on it, quiet everyone down. And even till this day, Martin, any files that the Ministry of Defense may have had on the Rendlesham incident coincidentally disappeared from the Ministry of Defense files. You look at the gap, and literally the dates of the Rendlesham case, December 26th, 27th, and 28th, any files pertaining to anything to do with this disappeared. This was something that Nick Pope of the Ministry of Defense recently brought up, and it's very sketchy, to say the least.
Right, right. Was it Lord Hill Norton that I'm thinking of that stood up and talked about this?
He did. I believe he spoke to the Prime Minister at the time about the case and said this needs to be researched. This needs to be investigated. There are many flaws and holes in this, and he was a big fan of all of these people coming forward about it. And I give him all the credit in the world for having the courage to do that in the place of power that he was. This could have been a big risk for him. And again, I commend him on what he did. And it ultimately has helped make this case stay open.
Let's see. Let's talk about young people. You're an advocate to get more young people involved. And one of the things that, you know, I bring up, and I don't want to be redundant on this show ever, but a lot of people are turning to their computers instead of going to conferences and things like that. How are you an advocate?
I am a firm believer that this is now a time of passing the torch. You have all of these veteran researchers, the Stanton Friedmans, the Peter Robbins, the Richard Dolans, who have done amazing work in their time and continue till today. However, I do see a younger batch of researchers cropping up. You have John Greenwald, the Black Vault, who has done amazing work in obtaining declassified files from the FOIA. You have Micah Hanks, who is a a skeptic believer who has some interesting theories on UFOs relating to time, to temporal time, and to also artificial intelligence. And I believe it's these new ways of thinking, Martin, that are bringing the field into sort of a paradigm shift. The social networking aspect has a lot to do with that. That's how a lot of us first meet when we enter this field. That's how I first met Peter Robbins and Larry Warren and yourself included. It has done amazing things to connect us all in a community that used to be about writing letters or making phone calls. I see this as, you know, a pro and con always, but the way that we're connecting these days, the younger generation is very in tune with that. And I think that's going to help them in the research. Again, they have to be careful where they're getting their source material from. There's billions of websites about UFOs out there, and which ones do you turn to and which ones are credible is an entire mystery in itself. But I am a firm believer that there is a shift happening and there are new ways of thinking coming in. It's no longer the days of nuts and bolts, which is very important, but new ways of thinking need to be done and need to reinvigorate a field that can easily become dated and almost stuffy. Like I said, a lot of these lectures, you see the same PowerPoints over and over again by some of these presenters, but the way that it's changing with this conference I recently attended, it's become more interactive. And like I said, there's families showing up to these things. There's teenagers, and I couldn't be more excited for the future of ufology.
Getting back to your play, because we're just about out of time here, do you have ambitions to possibly turn that into a film?
That's a great question. I do. With any of my plays, I always have that dream that it'll one day become a movie. I'm presently working on three adaptations of my plays into films. I did want to start with this Rendlesham play on the stage. I think it's perfect for it. If someone were to approach me about making a film, I would strongly, you know, tell them that I would like to be involved in the process. I mean, it's always tough when Hollywood gets their hands on these things, what they can do with it. And again, my purpose in telling this story is to tell a true and accurate story. So to hand it over to someone and not know what they're going to change or distort would ultimately scare me. So yes, if the opportunity arose, I would definitely look at it. I would want Peter Robbins and Larry Warren involved as well. And, of course, yeah, what more can you ask for? You know, film is the way. It's where the money is. You know, I'm not doing this for the money, Martin. People wonder sometimes what the motives of these people are, in the UFO field. I just want to tell this story. And if I can even open the eyes of one person or to an audience that's never experienced this, then that's really all I can ask for.
One more thing. I was searching around on the internet, you know, basically about yourself before this recording, and I saw something about computer hackers looking for gaining access to UFOs, and I do remember a case where this happened. What was your involvement in that? Were you the hacker?
I was not, unfortunately, Martin. I could barely get on Skype today. For as young as I am, my computer skills are close to none. I still write with pen and paper, as hard as that is to believe.
Yeah.
I did an article for Open Minds magazine about the Gary McKinnon case. This was during the time when he was ultimately set free. It took a long time for this to happen. He was going to be extradited to the United States for hacking NASA computers. Stating he found some very interesting things having to do with off-planet spacecraft and officers. That's a story entirely in itself. But what I did was I compared Gary McKinnon's case to a case that happened in the early 90s. Where another gentleman named Matthew Bevin hacked into Wright-Patterson Airfield, where supposedly the Roswell wreckage was being housed. And he was caught, and he was interrogated and brought to court in England. But when they approached the United States about what this gentleman had found, they refused to answer the question. They said it's not something that we can tell you about. And they said, well, then we don't have a case here. And he was ultimately set free. So yeah, it's pretty interesting how both governments handle these sorts of things. And I'm glad to say that Gary McKinnon is now a free man.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, thanks so much, Ryan. We will stay in touch because I'd like to announce when your play actually opens.
Oh, that would be fantastic, Martin. Yeah, it's listeners like yours and people like you who make these things happen, and I couldn't ask for more than that support. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. That's it for the show today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please remember that Peter Robbins is going to be on our forum from the 30th of March until April 3rd. Please check that out. Our website is podcastufo.com. And whatever you do, don't forget to stop by our website this Monday, the first day of April. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.